This is Juno Afternoon. We just spoke with Jonas Lamm and Oscar Vasquez about the book Spare Parts. Now, from a phone interview earlier in the week, here is Spare Parts author Joshua Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
It is nice to have you here. So Spare Parts started as a story, correct me if I'm wrong, called La Vida Robot, back in 2004 when you were working for Wired? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was I got a press release from these kids out in Phoenix, and it was a very strange press release. I didn't know it was. First of all, it wasn't a very good press release. You know, it had like syntax errors, and it was very hard to understand what they were trying to say. Something about a robot that they had built that had succeeded in some way, and I actually didn't know what to make of it, so I was on the verge of deleting it, but I just left it in my inbox. That was in, I believe, October of 2004, and then in about, I think it was December, it just kind of popped back into my mind, like, what was that weird press release? And so I dug it back up, and there was a phone number for the school, and I called the school and got through to the teacher, and he's like, oh my God, somebody called. I was like, yeah. And it's because you wrote a terrible press release.
Was that Freddie that answered the phone?
That was Freddie Lajvardi.
All right. And he, as we will learn, becomes this amazing teacher and mentor to these four students at Carl Hayden High School in Phoenix, Arizona, like the last place any of us would think for an underwater robotics team, right?
They didn't even have a swimming pool. So, you know, the idea that they would start, they would enter a underwater robotics contest sponsored by NASA and the U.S. Navy in the middle of the desert with no swimming pool and really no background in robotics, you know.
Right.
They had everything going against them.
Wow. And so you wrote this story in 2004. Did you have a chance to visit in writing that story? And then I know subsequently you've been back several times when you started working on the book. Tell us about sort of how you got to know Oscar, Lorenzo, Christian, Lewis, these two teachers, Freddie and Alan. How'd that all come to be?
So when I spoke to Freddie in December of 2004, he's like, hey, why don't you come out and check out the robot and meet the students? And I thought, okay, you know, maybe he explained that they had won this competition. And I thought, like, that sounds pretty crazy. So I flew out there in January of 2005 and was kind of immediately disappointed when I saw the robot because it was ugly. This was one ugly robot. It was made out of PVC pipe. It was painted all sorts of different colors, red and green and yellow. It looked like it had been pulled out of the garbage.
And its name was Stinky, right?
Its name was Stinky because when they built it, it smelled so bad. and the fact is, it had been pulled out of the garbage. There was a gallon milk jug, a plastic milk jug that was zip tied to the front of it, and that milk jug was straight out of the garbage can. So this thing had literally been built from garbage. And I thought that I had just wasted a trip to Phoenix and was starting to think about how quickly I could get back to the airport. And then I met the students. I met Oscar, Luis, Lorenzo, Christian. And they started to explain the robot to me. And one of the first things they did was there was this weird plastic briefcase that was glued to the top of the robot. They opened up the briefcase, and inside was this extraordinary arrangement of microprocessors and cables. And I very quickly realized that though it may look ugly, this thing was a very sophisticated machine that these teenagers had built.
And not to get into too much detail, but that suitcase was sort of a hack, right? It was a workaround because their robot had way too much tether and it wasn't operating well, so they needed to get more of that ballast and more of the weight into the machine in the water itself, right?
Yeah, like the other teams that showed up at this NASA U.S. Navy competition had kept most of the electronics above the water on the, you know, on ground, on dry land, for somewhat obvious reasons, right? The electricity and water, they don't go well together. And these kids, because they had built their robot out of PVC pipe, there was a lot of air inside the pipes, and that meant that it was very buoyant. It wouldn't sink. And so they're trying to figure out, well, how do we make it heavier? How do we get it to, you know, sink? And at the same time, they were having a lot of trouble with delays from the commands they were giving it on the surface. They would have to snake down the cable, and it wasn't working very well for them. And so they came up with a somewhat dangerous, novel idea of putting all of the command structure, all the circuitry, on the robot itself, and they found this waterproof briefcase, or what they hoped would be a waterproof briefcase, and kind of killed two birds with one stone there by shortening the length of time it took a signal to reach the machine and also increasing buoyancy. So it's an example of the kind of sophisticated thinking they were engaging in.
I don't want to give away the end for our listeners who haven't read this this story, but I guess we have to mention how well they did against MIT.
Well, let me put it this way. MIT has its own oceanic engineering department. These college students are devoted to building things underwater. They are specialized in that, and they're coming from one of the world's greatest engineering schools. And the team that showed up at Santa Barbara for this competition from MIT was also sponsored by ExxonMobil, which at the time was the world's largest company. They had thousands and thousands of dollars of backing. And they were going up against these kids from Phoenix who had, I believe, an $800 budget, roughly.
High schoolers.
High schoolers who had no business in the collegiate division, by the way. The kids from Phoenix had entered the collegiate division because they felt that they were going to lose, they were going to come in pretty far down the pack in the high school division. And so if that was the case, they might as well enter the collegiate division, and then they could go home and say they had lost to MIT.
And all four of these students, I believe, had learned English as a second language, and none of them were documented. Is that right?
Three of them at that time were undocumented.
Okay.
One of them had become a U.S. citizen at that point. But all four of them had come across the border from Mexico as kids, learned English, and, you know, integrated into the U.S. high school system. And they were looking for ways to be involved. And that's how they came across this robotics program.
And in your book, you document that journey for each of them. It wasn't easy learning English and learning how to be part of the American school system, was it?
No, I think it was particularly hard for Oscar, who will be coming to Juneau, I believe, and is quite an extraordinary person. He wanted to be part of the U.S. military. He joined ROTC, JROTC, I should say, in high school, and was Cadet of the Year, was just an absolute star on the ROTC program. I spoke to the commander of the program, who had been in the service for decades and had been supervising ROTC programs for years. And when I asked him how Oscar ranked as a cadet, he said he was the best he'd ever seen. And Oscar fully intended to join the Army, but when he went to enlist between his junior and senior year in high school, he was told that he couldn't because he was undocumented. And I think in the back of his head, he had known that it might be difficult to enlist, but I think he also thought that if he proved that he was the best, if he was Cadet of the Year, and more than Cadet of the Year, like the best cadet, you know, Phoenix had ever seen, that there would be room for him. And there wasn't. And so coming into his senior year, he went looking for other opportunities, and that's how he came across the robotics program.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Joshua Davis. He's the author of Spare Parts. It's the University of Alaska Southeast's One Campus, One Book selection here for the 2018-2019 school year. You know, so we just talked about sort of the framework for the story. We have these kids who I guess we should mention they're at a high school in Phoenix where you write something like 70% of the individuals that go there are getting free or subsidized lunches because they're below the poverty line. So this is probably not a school with a ton of resources. Would you agree?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a complex question because as individuals, you're right, 70%+ are qualifying for free and reduced lunch, and that's a barometer for their how close they are to the poverty line. But the school itself, Carl Hayden, the school district was trying to make it more diverse. And the way the school was doing that was by creating magnet programs. So there was a marine science magnet program at the school, which is partly why it spawned this underwater robotics program, despite not having a pool. And the idea there was if you create these very interesting programs, you're going to attract white students, basically, from other parts of Phoenix, because Carl Hayden is in West Phoenix, which is a predominantly Latino area, and the school's predominantly Latino. But that plan did not work. The school remained predominantly Latino. So the benefit was that there were these resources for these kids to begin building, or at least for the teachers to be aware that there was an underwater robotics program and then say to the kids, hey, would you like to enter this contest?
You know, I was trying to sort of brainstorm different themes and ideas that you're presenting or are presented through this story. We have the framework of the kids building this robot out of PVC pipe and going to Santa Barbara and beating MIT. But then there's all this stuff, it's largely a story about immigration, social equity, equity in education, these amazing teachers, team building, the story of the underdog. What else would you add to that list? There's so much in this book, really.
Yeah, I dedicated the book to Freddie and Alan, the two teachers, because I do think that's a really important part of the story. Without these two teachers, none of this would have happened. The kids wouldn't have had the opportunity. The kids, frankly, probably would have quit along the way if the teachers hadn't said, keep going, you can do it. We believe in you. Particularly for a population that doesn't hear that a lot. Freddie told me this story about how the news crews would come to Carl Hayden quite frequently to cover fights. And they would stand up and the newscaster would say, here we are, it's Carl Hayden. And you could almost hear in the tone of voice the word again. And that sends a message to the outside world that this is what this population is known for, fighting. And Freddie and the students took their robot out there to try to show the newscaster that these kids were doing something different, that they were trying to build a robot. And the newscaster said to them, that's great, that's very interesting, but that's not the story I was sent here to tell. And when you kind of give up on telling a complete picture of people and of a population, you end up reinforcing stereotypes. And so I think the effort that that Freddie and Alan made to create opportunities to grow these individuals as people, as engineers, is absolutely critical, and it says something about the value and the purpose of our education system in democracy.
What did this reporting on this and writing this book sort of teach you about immigration?
I, to be honest, hadn't thought very deeply about it when I first went out to Phoenix in 05. And also, I didn't, by the way, know that the story had anything to do with immigration. I thought it was just a bunch of high school kids who built a robot. It was only along the way that I started to realize that their immigration status was an issue. So in that process of learning that, I started having to do my own research and look more deeply into it. I grew up in California, so it's certainly, you know, we're surrounded by immigrants here in California, perhaps more than you might be if you were northern part of the country, or at least southern immigrants. If you're in the northern part of the country, you get a lot of Canadians. So I had to kind of dig into the dialogue and look into what are the roles. You know, we kind of give lip service to it. You know, immigrants are important to this country. This country is built on immigrants. But what does that actually mean? What does it look like? How do immigrants contribute to this country? There's obviously a fierce debate right now in the country about how do we think about that? And so I had to go on my own journey to understand it better.
We've been speaking with Joshua Davis. He is the author of Spare Parts. It's the UAS One Book, One Campus Selection. All right, Joshua, thank you so much. Anything else I'm missing? Anything you'd like to add?
That's it, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We cross Zimbabwe's border, flew over the dry fields of my homeland, coming into Joburg, the suntan swimming pools and the Soweto.